Hello and welcome to another Premier League preview podcast exclusively for you guys here on Patreon. I'm not joined today by Lewis Ambrose because Lewis Ambrose, as I speak, is probably in Dublin. He's not here to see me specifically, but maybe I'll catch up with him a bit later on and have a pint with him and his crew, so to speak. So Lewis is not around. Phil Costa, who usually fills in for Lewis, is also not around. So we're doing it a little bit differently today. But nevertheless, I'm sure you will enjoy the show. We are playing Manchester United on Sunday. So who better to talk to about Manchester United and lots more than Musa Okwanga? Hi, Musa.
My man, always a pleasure to be here, man. Thank you so much for having me.
No, my pleasure. The pleasure is mine. And the listeners, of course, because I get to hear your wonderful voice. And the laugh.
Laughter gets you everywhere.
That's all right. Let's start a bit with the transfer market, the transfer window in general, before we maybe talk a little bit, you know, specifically about Manchester United and what you guys have done. There was a tweet, I don't know if you've seen it, from Paul Hayward, and some of the numbers are just incredible. So Premier League clubs spending more than La Liga, Serie A and the Bundesliga combined, £1.9 billion. Chelsea spending more in one window than any other club in Premier League history. I haven't totted up the numbers yet, but I'd say it's probably about 1.8 billion of those 1.9 billion. They've just bought everyone. Manchester United smashing its own summer record, and Nottingham Forest signing more players in one summer than any other British club ever. It's been absolutely crazy, hasn't it? And when we think about the Super League and how people objected to the idea, the concept of the Super League. The Premier League is pretty much in itself a Super League, if not necessarily the Super League.
The only reason I would disagree with that is because there is a way back from this. In a way, there wasn't a way back from the Super League. So in terms of the regulation, the tools, the levers that clubs have, or that the Premier League has, and the government actually has, because, you know, especially post-Brexit, the government is looking for sources of income, revenue, redistribution, and it's got, you know, football is right there. Football is right there. Like, if it wants, if the government is horrified by, here's the thing, I expect sports commentators and supporters to comment on their horror at the inequality. I don't expect politicians to do that because they're in a position to do something about it and they have the leverage to do something about it. But these numbers do concern me, I'm not going to lie. Like, we've gone from, I was having a chat with Ryan about this on Stadio, like, you go from, you know, you have like a world-class player who goes for a certain amount of money, and, you know, you can almost square that with yourself, and not just a world-class player, one who's established. Let me first say that all the players who've gone for huge sums of money are like elite players, no question there, not knocking them individually. It's more that now the barrier to entry to acquire a player at the beginning of their career is now beyond so many. Like, so even like, here's the acquisition of Billy Gilmour by Brighton for 9 million.
Sure.
Will be looked at years to come, and they'll be like, how the hell did a player that good go for that amount of money when the rest of the market was just super heated? And the thing that worries me so much is that the value may not be there for clubs with less resources anymore to break into that sort of the higher reach.
I mean, do you genuinely think that the government might do anything about it?
I don't think it will.
But can it? You know, I know there's talk of regulation and there's talk of, you know, I think football is, people will say it's a business, it's an industry like any other, but it's not really. It is quite a specific, quite a unique industry in terms of how it operates, who operates it, and who's invested in it, right? And I think there's probably something to be said for, like, every football fan will think it's a good idea to maintain the connection between fans and a club. So someone can't come in and just ruin a football club the way we've seen it happen with football clubs in the past. And fans are kind of helpless. Fans are wedded to a football club in a way that players, managers, and in many cases owners absolutely are not. But at the same time, how does the government regulate someone like Todd Boehly? Who's come in, he's bought Chelsea, he has splashed as much money as anyone has ever splashed in the transfer market, and he's doing so because, you know, this is part of the fun for him. This is part of what, you know, how on earth can they regulate anything with people with the kind of power and the kind of influence and the kind of money that these owners have, I just don't see what they can do.
Okay, so let's say a tax on transfers above a certain amount. So a transfer beyond a certain price, a certain value, let's say beyond like 5 million, 10 million, and a percentage of that is, I don't know, tax redistributed. Yeah. I don't know, for example.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing out an idea. Yeah. But I'm not saying that solves a problem. I'm just saying that one fear I have with football and prices now is the sense of powerlessness, that nothing can change.
Mm.
The last time I was on your podcast, someone was like, all right, Jeremy Corbyn. I think someone...
Well, he had some good ideas.
Well, you know, it just, you know, I want to say, like, I mean, look, it is a bit distressing to see that. And I say that as someone who's the fan of, you know, a wealthy club.
Mm.
Not just about me. It's about football. It's about redistribution. Like, you know, don't get me wrong. We're going to talk about the transfer business. We're going to talk about bringing in a player like, you know, Antony, a player like Casemiro. United could just spend their way out of trouble. Like all of a sudden, they had a crisis. They had a relegation crisis. All of a sudden, they just spent a ton of money and they were out of it. And some might say, look, that's fine. And I get it. I get that. I get that approach. I'm not even saying those people are necessarily wrong. I'm just saying that it's bewildering and baffling to see such huge sums going into football and just the rest of the country struggling, because it makes you think to yourself, well, if we've got this booming economy that is the Premier League, which is housed in the UK, in which the UK, you know, supporters have their eyes trained on it and their wallets trained on it, it just feels like it's not being well. It feels like the redistribution of the money coming into the Premier League is not happening at a level that it should be, because if we've got this incredible product, why aren't we doing more? I don't know. And listen, the sums pale in comparison compared to what the country needs. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
No, it's more like, couldn't we be doing more just to even water the roots of the football league?
Sure.
And the non-league. I don't know, what are we doing about redistribution within the game itself? That's my own sort of little minor whinge.
No, I mean, I get it. You can't help but look at what's going on and look at where football is and where it fits into society. And part of, you could say on one hand, like, it's more important than ever that people can go to football and enjoy 90 minutes without worrying about the stress of paying their heating bills or gas bills or whatever it is. And as something that has a role to play in society, it's extremely important. But who pays in the end for what football clubs spend? I know there's a certain amount of largesse from owners, but comes out of supporters' pockets. It comes in ticket prices. It comes, you know, all the TV subscriptions, all of those kinds of things that demand and require football fans to put their hands in their pockets over and over and over again, you know, without necessarily getting as much back as they should in some cases. And, you know, I have to say, I worry a bit. There's this great new development at Arsenal. I don't know if you're aware, but there's a group of young fans called the Ashburton Army who are in the stadium and they're making noise and they're singing songs and they're sort of like, I don't want to use the word ultras, but that's that kind of thing where they're all in the same section of the ground and they're all sort of driving this atmosphere. And it's incredible. Mm. And they're young and they're coming to football and they're able to come to football. But at what point does it become unaffordable for people?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And how do football clubs survive? How does fandom survive without making football as accessible as possible to the next generation and subsequent generations time and time again? Look, the away tickets cap is quite an interesting thing and it's a good development. But on the other hand, it's like you've got to pay £300 in a train to get from one game to another because they put it at the far end of the country on a Friday night. You know, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. These are questions we can't answer in 20 minutes, obviously, but they can. I mean, look, in the UK, look, Germany is by no means perfect in many respects. Don't get me wrong.
Mm.
One thing Germany did trial out was like a €9 train ticket that took you around the entire country. As long as you didn't go on the high speed trains, you can go on the regional trains, the ones that stop everywhere. But imagine what a €9 train ticket would do for match going fans.
Mm.
Like, it's unbelievable what it did. And you saw the emissions just dropped off the cliff. And also CO2 emissions dropped off the cliff, but also people just got around the country. And it wasn't perfect because, of course, there was some overcrowding because people were so desperate to travel at that cheaper price. But over time, I think that settles down. And then all of a sudden, travel's not a prohibitive budget. And then we talk about the beauty of the UK, a great country, great countryside. Well, it's no fun if people can't travel and see it.
Yeah.
It's no fun talking about the great atmosphere away grounds if only limited on people can actually provide it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, where's the fun in that? Where's the fun in just like, why are we privatizing away grounds? Why are we privatizing, you know, trains? It basically, it's privatization in all but name, these prices, frankly.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Anyway, no, that's okay. No, that's fine.
There I go again.
No, don't worry about it.
I see the color red and I go off.
I love these tangents. Don't worry about it. We're going to talk Manchester United in a minute, but maybe some of our eagle-eyed listeners might have seen you this summer at the Arsenal training camp in Germany with Ian Wright. And we spoke a little bit about this at the time. Yeah. And you spoke to me a little bit about Gabriel Jesus and Gabriel Martinelli, I think.
Mm.
But I'm just wondering now, you know, when you look at the Premier League table and you see Arsenal on top of the table, and you were there to look at some of the training, you could see the players, you could see what was going on. Are you surprised that Arsenal have started the season the way they did? I'm really keen to get your impressions on what you saw. You know, it's difficult. I don't want you to go into specifics and you don't have to relay conversations that you had with people. Unless you want to, but but just your overall sense of what was going on at that early stage of preseason.
So here's the thing: I've said to Ryan before, like on Stadio, like preseasons don't matter until they do. There's some preseasons that don't matter, but the Arsenal one really seemed to matter because the thing that really stood out in that training session, we got to see them in an open session and a closed one, and it was Gabriel Jesus. And I said, I think I text to you, I came, I was like, this man is absolutely locked in.
Yeah.
The way that he's combining with Martinelli was spectacular. Like there was a moment in training, he gets the ball and it's like, like a car wash, you know, where the car wash comes over the top of a car.
Yeah.
His first touch was like that. It wasn't like a normal touch. Like his feet were brushing over the top of the ball. Like he took possession at high speed off the center backs. They had an exercise. It was like a half pitch they're playing. Takes off the centre backs and just accelerates across, like there's four players, and he basically runs like in a flat sprint almost towards the touchline, like almost like across the face of the defence, then plays this beautiful pass with the outside of his right foot with his head down to Martinelli and puts him through. And I was like, oh my God, this man is like, and it was like, there was two things. It was the intensity with which the training just raised when he got possession. And then like his understanding of Martinelli was absolutely like just the symbiotic nature of it.
Mm.
And I remember watching going, this has to look good. This has to look good in the actual matches. And then, of course, he goes against Nuremberg 2 days later and scores after 90 seconds. And the funny thing was, he was on a hot streak the entire training camp. And I think you see Ian talking to him in the video going, this is it. Well, Ian is saying that because Ian's just seen him training.
Yeah.
And it was amazing because, you know, it's sort of the different generations of Arsenal striker. Like Martinelli's been there a couple of years and Ian's there. And then you have like Jesus there. And just Ian watching him in training and just going like, this guy's got the juice. And actually talking to Gabriel Jesus, I spoke to him very briefly, like lovely, lovely, lovely guy. And just talking about him at City and him now, and the sense that I got was that he was so ready to build something. Like he is fully aware that Arsenal, the point that obviously City are at, he had his time with them, he won a lot with them. And he was said, he was like, you know, I'm still young, I'm still doing my thing. But like the sense that he's still young, he's won so much. And frankly, like he's earned well, he's done well. Like he's made, if he stopped playing football tomorrow, he'd have a great career. But this is the beauty of it. Like what he sees, I think now is his experience at City and what he brings to Arsenal, the platform for his takeoff is like immense. Like he's actually playing in a weird kind of way. He's playing both with and without pressure.
Mm.
The pressures and all now, they're all career driven. They're not economic. They're like, let's go to that World Cup and avenge Brazil for 2014. And let's avenge my 2018 when I didn't score, even though he didn't get many chances in that. And it's also like, let me build something at Arsenal in terms of a legacy. And I said this before, I said, actually, Gabriel Jesus might well end up being better known for his Arsenal days than his City days.
Mm.
I think he's that good. I think he's that transformative signing.
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing it, you know, we're watching the performances and we're seeing the way he's gluing that front four together, you know, with Martinelli, with Saka, with Odegaard.
Beautiful.
It's, yeah, it is amazing. It genuinely is amazing. I think that's a really great point about the pressure and no pressure, because like financially, I'm sure he's doing very well and is doing very well at Arsenal. But I like when a footballer is willing to take, Look, I can say it as an Arsenal fan, I suppose. It is a step down to go from Manchester City to Arsenal, particularly this iteration of Arsenal that's building something, that's trying to catch Manchester City, whether that's even possible, you know, over the course of a season, given what they're doing now with that goal machine up front, whether it'll ever be possible again, I don't quite know. But there is an element of risk in that as well, and that in order to, you know, to drive your career in a different direction, I mean, he could have stayed at Man City, could have signed another contract. I'm sure he could have won another few Premier Leagues, be a, you know, 60% of the game's player. But to go somewhere and say, look, I know this is a club that has had great moments, has a great history, but it's quite a long history, or it's a history that's some way away, you know, barring some FA Cups of late. It's 2004 since Arsenal won the league. Your ambition is to try and get them there again. I mean, that's that shows a level of A, risk-taking, but also belief in what you can do and how you can impact that particular project without being, you know, egotistical about it, because I think he's a very humble guy. He's not at all, you know, the superstar is what he said. I don't want to be the superstar. But you've got to have some belief that you can be a very important cog in what is still a difficult project that they're trying to get underway.
I love it, though. But this is the thing, and look at him and Zinchenko. They're both... they're both supporting actors who've never had the lead role.
Mm.
And that's, I mean, Zinchenko certainly for Ukraine has the lead role. He's outstanding for them and he plays a more advanced position, which is really exciting, I think, for Arsenal to see what he does centrally over time. But what's exciting about Zinchenko is they're both, Jesus, and like two of my favorite 10 signings. If I had to name like top 10 signings of the transfer window, they'd be in the top 10, those two, because they come in and they instantly galvanize the team.
Yeah.
With the vision, with the talent, but also the experience and the desire. Like they've done it time and again and they've delivered. And some might say, well, without Jesus and Zinchenko, they might have won all that. I don't agree, actually. And I think Pep was well aware of what they both brought to the City side.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, it's time for a next stage, the next iteration of City. But I don't know. I just think that Jesus and Zinchenko are there at such an exciting point for Arsenal.
Yeah.
I think they're going to be as transformative as this iteration as maybe like a Pires was, you know?
Mm.
I think it's that kind of play. You know, Pires came in and just like, he was doing things on the wing that we hadn't seen before.
Sure.
Or hadn't seen for a while. And I think Jesus coming in, like I was a big fan of Vlahovic going to Arsenal, but actually I prefer Jesus in this configuration because he makes you more unpredictable.
Mm.
You know, one thing I'll quickly say is what he reminds me of now is he reminds me of that amazing Portugal team at Euro 2000 where you had the front four, but there was nobody to mark.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The movement.
Yeah, you had no one to mark. Yeah, yeah. It reminds me very much of that.
Right.
Yeah.
What about, just very finally on this, the relationship between Martinelli and Jesus, which you will have seen on the training ground. We're seeing it in games as well.
I love it.
It. Yeah. I mean, these guys, I don't know, sometimes like players on the pitch, they can just connect really quickly, can't they? And that's what seems to have happened here. I know, look, obviously there are things they have in common, like their name and their nationality and probably a mindset, particularly when it comes to what they need to do to make sure they get in the World Cup squad. But beyond that,
there's something else going on.
There is, isn't there?
In the game. It's the fact that they can both play, not so much Jesus as a 10, but they can play all across the front line.
Mm.
They can play certainly in the front three positions. They've occupied that. And also, they have this approach to the game where, yes, scoring is important, but it's not necessarily important that they score. They go out there and their whole thing is disruption. Like, you know, Martinelli is like, I want to go out there and break the field down. I want to just go away and erode. He's like a sort of tidal wave battering away at like a city's defenses. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and what I love about Martinelli is, he's like, I'm there to create space, create chaos, and others can benefit. And the beauty of that is over time, you're going to see Saka come into a run of form. Saka's going to go on a scoring run.
Mm-hmm.
Odegaard will go on because there's the amount of disruption. You know, there's games when Jesus doesn't score and he's been the best player on the pitch.
Mm.
And he's happy with that. And I love that for him because some strikers don't score for three or four games and they're like, I'm out of it.
Mm.
But they're constantly disruptive. And that's what's so exciting. That I think that is the shared philosophy they have, I think, is what makes them so dangerous.
Yeah. Let's talk United. Erik ten Hag came in during the summer and obviously he's had great success at Ajax. Do you see parallels in any way between United and Arsenal? Because, I mean, I think it's fair to say that things at United have slipped as they did.
Yeah, yeah, my God, yeah.
with Arsenal, and we had the same kind of situation in many ways with these incredibly powerful legacy managers who had been so wedded to the very fabric of the club that when they leave, even if Alex Ferguson stayed in a kind of ambassadorial role or whatever it was, you know, a lot comes apart when these guys go. And maybe Arsenal, fingers crossed, touch wood, et cetera, have got it together a little bit more quickly. I think we forget how long ago it was when Alex Ferguson left United. But, you know, is there, with the appointment of Ten Hag, very good coach, very good manager, do you have any concerns that maybe the executive structure at the club isn't quite where it should be?
Oh, look, I think, look, I've said this maybe before, but I think that Wenger left Arsenal in a far better condition than he was given credit. Like, I think Wenger hung on longer than he should have done. I think he's admitted that himself. He stayed maybe longer than he should have done. At the same time, the fundamental condition Arsenal were left in was, I think, a good one. Like, it didn't help that Emery was not a best fit. Emery, I think, is a brilliant manager. He's just not the best fit for Arsenal. I think that's fair.
Yeah, wrong guy at the wrong time, for sure.
Absolutely. Whereas Arteta coming in, Arteta had to do a bit in terms of getting the basis of the team in place before he could play the more expansive game he wants to. And isn't that, we're now seeing that. What I think I respect so much about Ten Hag is the bravery of some of the early decision making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guts to sort of drop established players, players with a huge pedigree from elsewhere, but also players with a huge pedigree and, you know, English players, like to drop Shaw, to drop Maguire. That's a big deal, I think. And we've seen in patches, again, you know, the preseason, you can't read too much into it, but there's a fluidity of football that we saw in the preseason, that we saw again in the Leicester game, where you see the ideas, you know, like the early Arteta, where you saw that goal, the Arsenal goal, which is sort of like, play out from the back, down the right, switch, okay, cross, bang, corner, like left to right, bang. You saw it, you're like, okay, that's going to work as a fundamental, that's a go-to goal. And every, you know, big teams have go-to goals. United, it seems like fast transition, switch again, and it's in. And I think the skeleton of what Ten Hag is building compared to the skeleton of what Arteta is building, by that analysis, we're maybe like 2-3 years behind. Well, maybe, let's be honest, 3 years behind where Arsenal are, I would say, at this point.
Wow.
I think it's 3 years. Yeah, because I'm not knocking United. I'm not knocking them. I'm just saying that Arsenal have an idea and a plan and players who know the plan. They brought in players who know Arteta from City, and that kind of supercharges you.
Sure.
And I think there's just no, I'm not knocking United. I'm just saying shortcuts. There are shortcuts to... And I know we finished second in the league, but it's about the direction of travel. It's not about coming second 1 year and eighth the next. It's about consistently, can we be consistently top five, top four, top three? I think Arsenal have the platform, and we can talk about the sort of the transfer market very briefly. They have the platform, maybe just one player midfield short, one or two short. They have the platform to be a team that can be top four this year, I think.
Yeah.
And maybe even broach top three with a bit of luck. We, I think, are maybe 2.5-3 years from that.
I definitely think you're further behind in to use like Arteta-esque language in the process or the project. You know, definitely further behind. And I think what we've seen with Arsenal and Arteta is that, like, if you're convinced you've got the right manager, and to be fair, that they've been convinced that he was the right man, patience is actually a very strong virtue, because you can go through difficult periods and you can have a bit of up and down, and it's not going to stop fans complaining. It's not going to stop people having their opinions or anything like that. But if, you know, you can see that this is the right guy and you give him the time, then you will see the fruits of the labor and so on. Ten Hag, you would have to assume, is going to be given that by Manchester United.
I think he should be. Yeah. I think at this point, you bring in a coach of that quality, and they've backed him in the market, to be fair. I mean, look who they brought in. You bring in Casemiro, Antony, and Martinez. Those are not signings for a manager who's going to be around for two seasons. I think they'll give him his time. And actually, I will say this about Arsenal. One of the most impressive things about them in recent years is the time they've given Arteta. There are other owners who would have blinked. There are other CEOs who would have definitely,
for sure,
brought out the hatchet. I mean, we've seen... There's a ton of them. I mean, that really tough run he went through, I think the FA Cup, actually, funnily enough, because Arsenal won FA Cups before, but something felt symbolic about this victory because it was almost like, this is what it looks like when the plan works. I really felt like that FA Cup win was like a foreshadowing of if you give this man the tools, he can deliver, if that makes sense. Even stuff like the Community Shield game against Liverpool, like it sounds like people might laugh, but in those performances, I saw like opposing coaches were really trying to win it. They weren't handing over those trophies. Those were like things that Arsenal had to be at the sharp end in. And I've said this many, many times. We're going to see in the next couple of years why Pep was so angry that Arteta left. Because Pep knew what Arteta could become.
Mm.
And we're seeing it, actually. I think we're seeing it in patches already.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's, you know, there are always doubts when times are tough. But, you know, the FA Cup win you referenced in 2020 during lockdown, it was like a big step forward. But in order to take more steps forward, you've got to take a couple of steps backwards. And it's not to excuse anything, but I think in a project of this size, there are always going to be things that sidetrack you and derail you and things like that. But you mentioned United's transfer business. I've got them here. Let me just have a look. So Antony in from Ajax, Casemiro. I mean, it's one of those deals, isn't it? The Casemiro one that I saw people reference on social media, and it's like, I can't believe they're paying £65 million for this guy, blah, 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 the age he is. I mean, I don't think economically you could argue it's a good deal, but when it comes to sheer football quality, it's almost a no-brainer when you look at what Manchester United have had in midfield to bring in somebody with that experience, with that winning. If we talk about the winning mentality at Arsenal, or that Jesus and Zinchenko are brought in, you know, five-time Champions League winner Casemiro from Real Madrid, I mean, that is a next-level signing, even if it's one of those that economically the Glazers are going to have to eat, no resale value and everything else. But are you happy enough with the business you did? Was there anything else you would have liked to see the club do?
Look, I mean, I cannot look. I think anyone who supports a club whose owners go out and spend that amount of money in one window cannot reasonably complain too much. They can't really, you know, you can't complain with, you know, an elite talent in the form of Antony that's 22 and he hasn't, obviously he's a long way from his peak. He's an outstanding player or talent. Casemiro just brings, Casemiro, like one of the great defensive midfielders of his age. And yes, there'll be concerns about physical wear and tear and all the rest of it. Fundamentally, to have him there protecting the back line is a huge deal. Dubravka in goal, backup for De Gea, but also someone to challenge him was very important. And obviously Martin has mentioned before, like that's really solid.
Mm.
It's not just solid, it's good. It's like, it's good to very good, actually.
They're good players. Yeah, I mean, Martinez was somebody that Arsenal were after, not necessarily to play at centre-half, but to play as left-back. That was the plan for Martinez, yeah. I mean, it is an interesting one, isn't it? Because he's 5'9", and that's been a topic of conversation. I think we'll have to wait and see, you know, what happens this season.
But just jump in, there's a thing about Mascherano and Cannavaro weren't the tallest either.
I know. I was talking to somebody the other day. I was playing golf with a guy who used to sort of play semi-pro football, and we were just talking about like why he sort of quit. I think he was on professional terms and sort of fell out of the game a bit early. And he said, I wasn't that good in the air. Now, he's about 5'9", this guy. But the best guy I ever played with in the air was not a 6'4" central defender. It was a 5'7" central midfielder who just won everything. I don't know how he did it. He's, you know, it's all about the leap. It's all about how you can time things. But you know, the physicality of the Premier League, I mean, I think when the Manchester Derby comes along, the idea of Haaland versus Martinez in an aerial battle, I don't think I'd put too much money on your guy.
To be honest, I would put no money on Godzilla against Haaland in an aerial battle.
It's like, ridiculous, isn't it? It's just ridiculous.
I think, to be honest, the surest way to stop Erling Haaland in a derby is just to burst the ball before it gets to him. just pop it, you know?
tie his shoelaces together or something.
Absolutely, I mean, Haaland is another story. We can talk about Haaland all day, actually. But just in terms of the threat that he poses, defenders will work out because they always have. Listen, they found a solution for Christian Vieri.
Mm.
They found a solution for Romario. They found a solution for, you know, Brazilian Ronaldo. Actually, they didn't, but no.
I know.
No, they did. People find solutions. And I'm really excited to see how specifically Arsenal solve the Haaland problem, because actually Arsenal, that first half against City, we talk about all the time, Ryan and I, the first half against Arsenal last year was spellbinding.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
And I wonder what we're going to see the next. Is it October you've got them?
Yeah, I think it is. Relatively soon.
Interesting. Yeah, you've got an interesting month.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Derby, Liverpool. Is it Derby, Liverpool, and City
Man
as well?
City. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is.
That's a treat.
It is. I mean, I don't know where I'm going to put all 9 points, Musa, but
nine easy points, mate. You got lots of space behind you.
Finally, what are you expecting from this game on Sunday?
I'm expecting that the best team will win. Do you know what? I think we're better equipped to cope with the fluidity of your movement. The challenge is going to be the base of midfield for us.
And us. I mean, we've no Partey, no El Neni. That's
the challenge, yeah, the base of midfield for us. So who will get to our back four behind that midfield? Because we've got Eriksen, McTominay. That was fine for containment.
Mm.
But I'm not sure if it moves the ball as forward as quickly. And the problem is that you know the ball playing is going to come from Eriksen. Easy to isolate that. And one thing Chelsea have been very smart at, Chelsea have recruited ball players for the midfield really well. So if you stop one, you can't stop the other.
Mm.
And I think that, yeah, the game's going to come down to the centre mid, actually. That's what will be decided. So if you can swarm us there, we're in a bit of trouble.
Mm.
It's looking like it would be an Arsenal win on paper. But we've got to back this new spirit that Ten Hag's brought in.
Yeah.
In a one-off, we've got a good chance.
But look, at home, it's always not quite a form goes out the window game, but it's never going to be easy, for either side. We'll have to see. I don't like making predictions. It's just one of those things.
Yeah, no,
I
mean, really hate. It's just, fortune, yeah,
exactly. You know, we're playing well. If we can keep the momentum going, we'll give you a very good game, and you never know.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
All right. Well, listen, a pleasure as always to talk to you. Hopefully we can catch up again at some point during the season. And
if
people don't know, check out Stadio with Ryan Hunn, Arsenal fan as well. Great podcast. And we'll catch you soon, Musa. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed to Musa Okwanga. You can follow him on Twitter. He is @Okwanga. And of course, he is a co-host of the Stadio podcast, which you'll find on Ringer FC. So all that remains is a little bit of team news, which we didn't really get to from an Arsenal perspective. And normally we would do that if we were talking to Lewis or Phil. Mikel Arteta says he's hopeful on Martin Odegaard and Aaron Ramsdale, both of whom picked up knocks in the win over Aston Villa. They are being assessed, and he's hopeful that they can be involved, and fingers crossed they are. Alexander Zinchenko has not trained yet, so his participation looks in doubt. I saw somebody say that Ben White wasn't at the training session. Whether that's injury or not, we don't quite know. And, of course, Thomas Partey out for weeks, according to Arteta, but he's hoping that it might be a bit less than that. Mohamed Elneny out for months. So you would imagine that Albert Zambi-Lokonga will get another start, and this will be a tough test going to Old Trafford, particularly if United start Casemiro in midfield as well. It's going to make it quite the midfield battle, but we'll wait and see what happens. So look, fingers crossed we can go there and get the right result. As I said elsewhere, you can join James and I on Sunday evening. We'll be recording pretty much straight after the game, so we should have the podcast for you, I don't know, about 9, 9:30. Thereabouts, have a bit of post-game stuff to do before we can start recording. So join us for that. In the meantime, have yourselves a great weekend. Thank you for being here as always, and we will catch you on the next one. Cheers. Bye-bye.